Page 94, the Private Eye podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name's Andrew Hunter-Murray and I'm here in the Eye studio with Helen Lewis, Adam McQueen and Jane McKenzie. We're here to discuss all sorts of things that have been going on. Been quite a busy news summer so far. I haven't entered the doldrums yet, which is thrilling. So first of all, I think we should come to one of the big stories and the one which is on the cover of the latest issue of the mag. How could Nigel Farage have possibly seen this coming, that this might be a problem for him?
I want to start off by saying, how could Ian possibly have seen this coming? Like, that cover went to press on the Monday,
yes.
And then the story, his big everyone has wronged me speech, was on the Tuesday. I'm running the boat.
2 p.m., exactly the same time as the Prince Harry judgment, which we'll be talking about a bit later on, came through. It was just like a newsmageddon the day after we went to press.
I did see the Farage speech of him having his hissy fit and saying, I'm standing down, and I'm coming back and all of this. And I thought, oh, that's such a shame, because I hadn't seen the cover yet of the mag, and I assumed they would have gone with something else.
Nope, yeah. We got some cracking night. Where's your lolly from, Joe? It's fake. Was it fake? I want to say if it's fake ice cream, but that's not a pun on fake news.
Flake news. Yeah.
Flake news, okay. There we go. You watched that speech live. I did, because I've got problems in my life, apparently.
Okay.
But it was fascinating because it seemed to me a genuinely emotional outburst. He first of all wanted to take on the fact that people said, you know, people have been saying I've been looking ill very recently, like, you know, I'm fine, I'm absolutely fine. And then he seemed genuinely, personally, very upset about the idea that reporters had been to his daughter's house, which was later explained was the house he was registered a voter at the last election, and trying to put the allegations to him. But it was an extremely personal outburst. It didn't seem actually particularly strategic, although everybody immediately tried to portray it that way.
He's definitely taken this to heart, hasn't he? There's none of the sort of bonhomie or anything. It was a couple of days before when he was approached by a Sky News reporter at an airport, and he was absolutely furious. He came back for another go as well and said, you keep away from my family! So, and they pointed out they hadn't approached any of his family. None of his family were there at the time. He was there with a load of kind of reform guys. But yeah, he does. He's definitely taken this one to heart, hasn't he?
But this is the thing. I mean, there's a very angry tone about I don't know, if I was at the top of the polls, and I had been for a year, and still was, I think, even after all this, I would try to keep it light. But it seems like asking questions is going to get you in big trouble in Farage's Britain.
Immediately after it was announced that none of the other parties were going to run against him, which is not without precedent, right? The one that people talk about is that David Davies resigned from Halton Price and Howden and ran a sort of civil liberties. And then everyone went, OK, thank you, you know, David, we'll let you have your moment to talk about this. But you know, this is for you, not for us. And one of the ones I was particularly interested in is that Restore, the much further right party from Rupert Lowe, they're not running, even though it would have been a freebie media hits for them. They said this is the Nigel Farage circus. So despite a valiant rearguard attempt to say all the other parties are looking down on us, it's the uni party, no one cares, actually pretty much everybody across the political spectrum thought, let's let Nigel have this one.
Lawrence Fox is in there, isn't he? He's got it. He thought, I might pick up a few votes. As is the guy who dresses up as a fox, so it'll be a two-fox race.
Oh, great.
Good. Yeah.
No fox given.
I think the very funny element of the move is that Farage clearly thought, right, we're going to have a by-election. They'll all be standing against me, all the other parties. We'll be able to move the conversation on. There'll be all sorts of things we can bring up, whether it's immigration or whether it's crime or whatever. And now, finding himself completely alone in the race, he has managed to find a magnifying glass on him and the £5 million he's been given and the £1 million from the mother of the convicted fraudster, George Cottrell.
The retired stylist.
Yes.
Retired stylist, yeah.
Now I don't under know investigation many... from by the police over the source of that donation, which is unknown.
More regime investigations, you know.
I thought he's done this in order to do a kind of like Trump's second election victory, right? Which is to say, well, look, obviously the voters don't care. You know, I've gone to the court of public opinion about my donations and they don't care. This is just an establishment stitch-up. Yeah. However this plays out, I think he's been deprived of that ability to say, well, this is a ringing endorsement that they like me, not you, because the choice isn't really there.
Because they like me or Binface.
Well,
being
yeah.
Being liked more than Lawrence Fox is not that much of an achievement.
We should come on to Binface.
Right.
Declaration of interest. I've certainly met several times with Bin on and off.
I see what you've done there. I've been on Count Binface's podcast.
Have you?
Yes.
Wow.
Which is quite difficult because, to be honest with you, I went on it without having researched the lore. So he started going on about which planet he was from and I was like, I'm sorry, what?
Oh, the lore, right.
The lore, Lord of the Rings lore. Yeah. There's a whole very well filled out backstory for Binface.
Okay.
I think that regardless of your feelings about joke candidates, and I'm generally pro them because they add to the gaiety of the nation, it was very funny to see that all the people in Reform have basically only one setting, which is the establishment is against us. And seeing whichever one it was who said, who funds you? was just like a party with the deep state.
You pay for this bin. Yeah, yeah.
Right. Yeah. And then I think the ability to, it's as you say, that one of the things that's been difficult for Farage here is that he's usually coasted by on this series of not taking things too seriously. He's a happy warrior. Things don't get to him. And when you're suddenly furious about a joke candidate, that looks sort of petty and small. Whereas also been faced in the Makerfield by-election, and guess what? Andy Burnham just shrugged it off, took it, which is the way that you should play it. You know, just to use the joke by saying, what a good joke, rather than who funds you, Bin-Face, if that is your real name.
It's rubbish for the people of Clacton that Farage is willing to just kind of stop being their MP to get himself out of bother. They're kind of one of the country's most poor areas because of having Farage as their MP has been the butt of a joke for a couple of years, rather than anybody trying to say, well, actually, what can we do for the people of Clacton? There's a large area of Clacton which is doomed by sea flooding.
Really?
And
okay.
Nothing's being spent on the fact that these homes are worth nothing. Nobody will invest in it because it's going underwater really soon. And yeah, it's really hard to be the people of Clacton because their MP is useless for them.
Yeah.
Right, he's not held a huge amount of constituency surgeries. He's not seemed overly interested in them as a... Because this was one of the things was like, actually, I know that the prospect of Bin-Face winning is extremely remote, but I sort of thought you could parachute in any random person to have a crack at being their MP, and I don't think they would necessarily do worse as a constituency MP, just on average,
just
than Farage.
A small amount of constituency casework and they're already ahead.
Yeah.
There are, I mean, a lot of Reform's heartland, as it were, is coastal and often quite deprived constituents, isn't it? Richard Tice, the party's deputy leader, is Boston and Skegness, I believe. And so there's a lot of that. And Clacton is where Douglas Carswell of UKIP defected from the Conservatives about a decade ago and had a by-election for it. But that was because it was a change of party.
And had a horrible fallout with Nigel Farage, then leader of UKIP, who was extremely graceless and cross about that one too.
There are reasons why people there feel left behind by every other party, because it's, you know, he's got real deep problems.
Yeah. Are there early indications of what people in Clacton think about the kind of circus that's about to descend? Or the fact that it's been, you know, that Farage has forced this on them, as it were?
I think that the people of Clacton are sort of more invisible than anybody thinks they are. They're, because it's such a poor area, they're the sort of most offline people in the UK that kind of aren't getting their voice heard or out there.
I mean, he won a really resounding majority at the 2024 election. He won more than the second and third place, which was Labour and Conservatives combined. Mm. So there is also, we should acknowledge the fact that Conservatives didn't run in the seat because they think they would lose to him.
Right.
And also Restore didn't run in the seat because they think they would lose to him. Like, everything says that he, you know, you'd expect a very low turnout in a by-election anyway, even if there were other candidates. In that case, it's going to play out, I would say, in a very straightforward way, all the indications are.
Yeah.
But you're right to say about the polling, because actually the headline polling nationally is that the majority of people do think the donations are whiffy. It's not a situation in which it's only two Oxford graduates sitting in the BBC who are upset about this, or whoever the establishment... Well, we're going to talk about who the establishment is maybe in the Prince Harry case, because it's not Prince Harry. Literal Prince Harry. But this is actually something that genuinely... People are very sensitive to corruption. They were very sensitive to Keir Starmer's freebie glasses. They don't like it when politicians seem to be on the take.
I think it's anything which has a concrete noun is much easier to make real in people's minds. So free glasses and suits is a perfect example of that. When it's just finance, I think it is harder because people sort of know that there are political donations and they sort of know that there's a bit of access for money trading going on. But the thing is, about £5 million paid into your personal bank
account.
It's
the sheer amount, isn't it? I mean, you look back to the last sort of like really, really big bout of outrage about this kind of thing. And it's MP's expenses back in 2009.
Right.
And none of the sums that were involved in that ever approached £5 million being claimed by anyone, you know, by a single MP. And then to be so, I mean, he does not have a leg to stand on, absolutely. However you look at the rules, that money needed to be declared. Just on a sort of moral and ethical way, it obviously was something that people deserved to know about. The people of Clacton, as we've been talking about, deserved to know that their MP was personally in hock to Christopher Harborne for that amount of money. I mean, it's just extraordinary to try and blast it through and say none of this matters and none of the stuff about George Cottrell, who has been convicted of crimes in America and wrote a book called How to Launder Money, I believe.
Was picked up in America at an airport with Farage.
Mm.
You know, when he was picked up and arrested to be banged up in the first place, Nigel was there at the scene.
But I think America is a big part of this story, because the other thing that Farage said in that speech is, I don't have to be here. I don't have to do this. I could be earning some real money. I could go to America.
Mm.
And that was both an ill-advised thing to say, in my view, and also extremely true. If he was, he could be doing that conference circuit of CPAC, where he was like Mr. Brexit, and all of those, to my mind, slightly ghastly conferences where people sit in a room and listen to various has-beens going on about their right-wing populist triumphs. Viktor Orban presumably joining that circuit quite soon. but that came to me, is that he must be looking at the money that Trump is making. Trump's getting his own Air Force One, you know, from the Qataris, or like, you know, Trump's sons have made these millions from crypto, and he's got measly 5 million quid from some crypto guy. In his mind, that is not very much money. But as you say, in the mind of the average British working person, that's quite a big money for someone to give you just as a lovely present for no reason.
Yes. I mean, a lot of the stories we've covered in Private Eye about politicians getting payouts for lobbying stuff are really small amounts of money, and people are still cross about those. There's sort of £20,000 here and there for sort of representing corporate interests in Parliament. And we're always outraged about those, and people generally think MPs shouldn't be doing that.
Well, but these are the ones we know about as well, aren't we? I mean, we had the 5 million from Harbour and was broken by The Guardian sort of a month, 6 weeks ago, and then the Sunday Times revelations about all of the cash and stuff coming in from George Cottrell is an entirely new thing. Farage's only defence of this is, it's none of your business, none of you need to know about this. For all we know, there are millions more coming in from all sorts of other people. But that's why this stuff needs to be declared. I mean, there is a reason for transparency in politics.
But there's a really well-established thing that Nigel likes money. I mean, his expenses when he was an MEP, his pension, I think, from the European Parliament, these have all been gone into in quite a lot of detail. Before he became an MP at the 2024 election, there was loads of stuff about how he'd done his... It's not an OnlyFans, it's a Cameo. Sorry, it's a
Cameo.
It's so hard to get those cleared up.
Yeah, but anybody who'll take essentially to what to him is pocket change to do, you know, hello, Mr. and Mrs. Shipman, I'm, you know, here on the your son Harold's birthday. Like all those joke things that he's been doing on Cameo. Mm. That's somebody who is thirsty for cash.
I mean, I should declare another interest here, which is that I'm a donor, because I make that Radio 4 show, The Naked Week, and we paid Nigel 75 quid to read out the credits 1 week. He didn't know he was doing it, but we were saying, thank you, dude, Jason and Katie and John. Anyway, so, you know, I'm up to...
It's also, then try and use the defence, I can't be bought by anyone, when you've literally been flogging cameos for 85 quid a pop.
This is the thing,
it just doesn't wash.
This
sorry.
Is the cultural trope of rich people don't like money. Yes, they do. That's how they got rich.
Mm.
That's why they're rich. And I should say, the rules are pretty lax, in my opinion. As in, you can take 5 million quid from someone. All you have to do is declare it. You just have to say you've done it, that's all. And then someone else can say, well, you did take this money from this person, didn't you? Mm. And you have to say yes. Even then, you may well get away with it because it won't be made a big enough story.
Mm. But that's what stuffed him, because I was just trying to think back to like things like cash for questions and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Essentially, we do have this unwritten way that actually public shame is what makes you not do these things. I sense that may be a losing tactic when it comes to Farage. But the idea of sanction by the Parliamentary Standards Commissioner does exist, right? He has now, which comes back to what you were saying last time about the fact that maybe becoming an MP has been a tricky thing for him.
Mm.
It has moved him into the legitimacy of saying, I'm going to compete and I'm going to try and be Prime Minister.
Yeah.
And it has exposed him to a huge amount of now rulemakers that he does not feel are legitimate, but do nonetheless have power over him. And then to go back to Trump, this is exactly, we'll see this play out again, which is either he has to accept the sanctions, or more likely, he has to try and turn over the entire table and destroy this whole regime, destroy the idea you have to declare anything. That's the only way he can bulldoze through to power, in my view now, which is exactly what Trump did. Trump said, go on, enforce all these rules. Oh, no, you can't. They don't functionally exist anymore.
Right. And I think people don't really care about the... If there was a judgment and he was banned from Parliament for 3 days or whatever, you know, suspended from the Commons for 3 days, that's a story which I think doesn't quite catch enough interest to make it a serious and lasting block of damage to him. But this, because it's so big and it's so public, I think it does make a lot of people who were thinking, yeah, OK, reform, that seems reasonable. We've got a lot of problems. The other two parties haven't sorted it. There are plenty of people who were thinking like that, who are beyond the reform base, but who reform do need to win an election. I think those people are the ones who will be looking at this and thinking, this is embarrassing.
I'm going to interject my normal note here, which is to say that Reform are nonetheless still the top polling party. Yeah. Labour have had a bit of a bounce, the Burnham bounce, which I suspect will be about as long-lasting as an ice cream. But, it is entirely possible that Nigel Farage will stay the leader and will contest the next election and will make huge electoral gains nonetheless, mm-hmm. which is why I think we have to keep talking about this, because unless you enforce and patrol these boundaries, they degrade, and it will not be good for British politics if it becomes more like American politics, in which eye-watering sums of money are chucked at politicians to get them to serve corporate interests. Can I talk about a little bit about Restore?
Yeah.
So one of the things I also think has been a genuine problem for Farage is that the right-wing media online ecosystem, the kind of fascist boomer Facebook pipeline, if you will, he's been severely challenged by Rupert Lowe and Restore and a couple of really key players in this who are Americans who get dabble in British politics are now much more enthused about what they see as the kind of full fat Coke version of this, which is Rupert Lowe. So he was on Joe Rogan's podcast, now one of the top performing podcasts in the world, Rupert Lowe. And Joe Rogan started off by saying, I'd like to say a thank you to Elon Musk, Jordan Peterson and Brett Weinstein, former member of the Intellectual Dark Web, for setting this up.
Sorry. Intellectual Dark Web, bless them.
I did need that glossing, I'm afraid.
But Rupert Lowe went on Joe Rogan, and yeah. it was fascinating for two reasons, as someone who watches all this stuff. First of all, you've got all of these memes, a few of which were so dank I didn't even know them and had to look them up, but I imagine are completely common currency in this world. And the other thing is how that podcast format is the enemy of fact-checking. Mm. So the one that he got into trouble for was saying handguns were banned in Britain after one murder in Dunblane. Mm. So you had lots of Scottish MPs saying, actually, it was more than a dozen children and their teacher. It was, you know, there was a reason. Also, the other thing is, I don't think there is any massive pro-gun lobby in Britain that sees this as a terrible injustice, actually. And then he said my father had to give up his shooting pistols, which he shot at Oxford, very man of the people, and said it's very, very hard to get guns. And I thought, it's actually, I've got a relative who owns several shotguns. If you've got no criminal record,
he hasn't had a problem because famously he got his assistant to shoot his own dog, didn't he? Rather than pay to go to a vet. This was Nadine Dorries' great argument in Makerfield, was that Rupert Lowe had his own dog shot and got an assistant to do it. The dog would have had to be put down by the vet, but he does know now, shotgun out. And now we're saying about no challenge. I'm taking this directly from Nadine Dorries in the Daily Mail, so I'm making it into
terrible
trouble.
That's where you get all your news. You love that column. But he said essentially someone made a fake accusation that he was, you know, he'd threatened Zia Youssef of Reform, and then people came around and interviewed him about his guns, and this was an imposition on his liberty. I'm kind of in favour in a world in which someone's accused of wanting to, you know, perpetrate violence, and someone, the police, go around and check their firearms are secured. That's okay with me. But anyway, so would you like a short list of the people that Rupert Lowe believes have ruined Britain?
Oh, yes. Okay.
Some of these you're going to expect, some of these you're really not. Okay. The police.
Band. Sting.
Sting, personally, and whoever the other people in the police turn out to be. The judiciary, because they're trying to scrap jury trials so that they can rig trials.
Right.
The World Economic Forum. Classic. You were expecting that, weren't you? The Bilderbergers. Retro.
I haven't heard about them for a while, yeah.
The Fabian Society.
Okay.
Yes, Jane, the correct look. The Fabian Society.
This is not the fans of the model Fabio.
Gosh, they're always getting each other's posts. It's a nightmare. Can you just remind our listeners who the Fabian Society?
Yeah, Labour think tank. He says every Labour MP is a member. It's actually about a quarter of them.
Right.
Keir Starmer is a member. But it's a Labour think tank. And he says their logo is a wolf in sheep's clothing, which it's true. It's from the 1920s. They also thought it was kind of awesome. But he presents this as being incredibly sinister.
I love a conspiracy theory that's like, they're hiding in plain sight. They put something evil there and only I have spotted it. Yeah. You wouldn't, would you?
No, you wouldn't
have the wolf in sheep's clothing if you were trying to do evil. it's like, you'd have a fluffy bunny,
you'd have a sheep.
Yeah. No wolf at all.
Just the sheep. Okay. The Nudge Unit.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah. No, this is a Cameroonian thing, isn't
Cameroon
it?
Cameroon era, and it was designed to encourage people on things like, was it diet and exercise? And it was encouraging healthier.
Why not try eating apples?
Some of these were more elevated policy propositions than that one, albeit useful. But his theory was that the COVID, they sinisterly nudged people towards getting the COVID jab, which Rupert Lowe didn't have because he is, quote, a pure blood.
Okay.
Yeah, I was like, after having a long riff on immigration, I probably wouldn't have described myself as a pure bub, but you do you. Mm-hmm. Baby boomers, based, agreed with him on that one. Rory Stewart's wife.
Right.
Okay.
Because the charity that she works for took money from USAID, which is obviously, as we all know, a huge funnel for money, CF, Elon Musk, I put it in the wood chipper.
Right.
Okay. But good to see some accountability.
Just Rory Stewart's wife, not Rory Stewart.
No. For once, he got away scot-free.
Feminist thinking, I suppose. Yeah. Maybe
he's angling for an appearance on The Rest Is Politics, I'm sure.
Aren't we all? Yeah. Tony Blair, because, quotes, he looks like Beelzebub with his white hair now and his piercing blue eyes.
Mm.
Is that what Beelzebub looks like canonically? Please write in. The public sector. There's too many of them. They're sapping our society. And here we go. Here's one I'd never heard about before. Have you ever heard of a conspiracy theory about the Haldane Society of Socialist Lawyers?
No.
It's a socialist...
I want to.
It's a socialist law society, which Keir Starmer belongs to, given that he was both a lawyer and a socialist. He calls them, Rupert Lowe calls them, the Fabian Pabloist Haldane Society, which has a malign philosophy. Do you know what Pabloists were? It's a type
That's
of Trotskyist.
What Starmer was, wasn't it? Yeah,
yeah.
Briefly, as a young man.
It's a type
of Trotskyist, yeah. But I was like, this is some deep cuts from Rupert Lowe here. It's just like, he's heard of conspiracy theories about the deep state you haven't even heard of. Like their early albums.
It'd be exhausting holding this many sort of villains in your head at one time.
Well, it's also really interesting because he was really there to talk about his rape gang inquiry report, which I've read. It runs through some really disturbing testimony, but most of it anonymous or pseudonymous, no attempt to corroborate it, some incredibly over the top exaggerations of the type that if someone came to you and, you know, any of you were doing the story on them, you would go, this is an extraordinary allegation. I'm going to need extraordinary evidence. Like people being raped by dogs, someone opening a van and there being 15 women in cages in the back, right?
It's like Carl Beach all over again, isn't it?
Well, yeah. This is the thing. I'm sure there are real allegations in there and really disturbing stuff, but one of the hardest things about doing those allegations is separating out the things that you can actually prove and then only printing the things you can prove, which people are really unhappy with when it turns out there was a scandal. But if you go too far, like Carl Beach, and you just say, well, anything anyone says to me, I'm going to write it down, that's equally problematic.
Funny, isn't it? I mean, Rupert Lowe comes across sort of less as a mainstream politician, which you'd probably be glad to hear, as just a man who's got a very specific set of interests, which don't necessarily, some of them happen to have coincided with kind of public views on immigration and things at the moment, and not on grooming gangs. But like you said, the gun law one is a really weird one. That's for an American audience, it works, but people in Britain aren't. I mean,
that's not been
generally held to be one of the massive successes, wasn't it?
But it's all libertarian. It's all libertarian in a very American way, which is I don't want people telling me what to do. But it is all of a piece. It's like, you know, no one can tell me to get a COVID jab, even though it will help other people. No one can tell me to put my guns away, even though it will stop school children getting shot. Nobody can tell me what to tweet and what not to tweet. That's the kind of connecting thread through all of these things, and that's part of the worldview. Mm. But you're right, his affect is really interesting because it is very British. Like, he reeks of kind of like guy at the end of the bar and the golf club having a martini and telling you some stuff. Like, it is not Tommy Robinson sort of street thug.
Mm.
And actually, Tommy Robinson has done things like the Jordan Peterson podcast. Like, on a class basis, he's going to find it harder to get a hearing in those American podcasts where they love what they see as a kind of British toff, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
So Rupert Lowe has been working the circuit. And again, like Nigel Farage, he might decide that actually that to him is a more receptive and congenial audience than British electoral politics.
Well, what Farage doesn't like is having to take the responsibility and the accountability, isn't it? I mean, it's much, much easier if you can just go on podcasts and, like we do, just talk nonsense.
I hear. That's very popular.
Jane, you have been writing a little bit about defence and procurement.
Yes, for many years, yes.
Yeah.
So it's obviously been in the news recently because the latest defence investment plan was announced, which in theory we're going to spend some more. It's an interesting question, spending more in defence, because whatever we pledge to spend in defence, particularly on equipment, we always seem to end up spending a lot, lot more because we're so poor at buying things.
Yes, it's a really, there are all these weird things going on when you think about defence expenditure, which is we seem to be spending these huge amounts. We seem to have fewer troops, ships, planes, all of that than we've had at any point in our history. that it doesn't quite match up. And yes. Sure, does the overspending count towards our NATO commitment? Can we say, well, actually, we went massively overspent on this?
Yes, we went massively over budget on this project. But what it does help with is that it adds to the percentage of our GDP that we're spending to help us with NATO.
So that's not helpful in a way.
We have entire projects where they make such a cock-up of buying things that we managed to spend going on £1 billion on something and not really get it or get to use it.
Yeah.
There are projects like WatchKeeper, where it ended up, I think, 14 years late. This was a sort of older generation of drone, autonomous flying craft. It went so many years over schedule and massively over budget that by the time that we had them, they were out of date.
Wasn't there a vehicle that rattled so much that it really affected people's hearing? It was kind of dangerous to use.
That's right, the Ajax vehicles, which, yes, a couple of times now we've come close to saying, right, let's cut our losses. And although we've spent hundreds of millions on them already, let's just not, because they're injuring people without anybody having to go to war. Just the testing phase is causing really quite serious injury to
extremely
people.
Lethal vehicles, but unfortunately only if you're in
to our side.
Yeah.
That's right.
I wanted to actually quote a letter that we'd had, and this was off the back of a defence story, because I think the really interesting thing that you write about, Jane, is that there's a lot of debate about percentages and 3.5% versus 3% and 2.65 versus 2.66 and all of this. But you often write about the actual things that are being bought and where the money is being spent. This is from a correspondent and subscriber, I hope, Julian Page, who wrote about the new class of Dreadnought submarines. Mm. And the process started in 2016. The first ones won't enter service until in the 2030s, and the last of the, I think it's four that are being bought, won't enter service until the 2040s. And Julian Page wrote, "This is equivalent to starting to build a class of four ships during the First World War and not seeing them all in service until the Second World War."
Wow.
What is going on?
Yeah.
I think that's what you have insight into. What is going on?
It's an interesting thing, because in some ways, some of our greatest military successes have been by people with a map and a pair of scissors and no budget at all. I mean, look at things like the early SAS. They were stealing their equipment, so that was very cheap. The kind of small drones that we're working with Ukraine with, like cheap and cheerful and great. But when it comes to very big spends, everything gets caught up in a sort of defence procurement, lovely dinners. There's a great deal of the budget, I think, goes into the defence sector, wining and dining the people who are buying the things. So obviously, some of the money has to go there. However, every quarter, there is a hospitality register showing what people who are two-star and above within the military have had. And every time, there's a great many agreeable dinners on the list.
Okay, wait, but this is being paid for by the defence firms?
Yes.
Oh, I see, but we're out of the money.
We're giving them all that money.
We're paying them to
and
build the things.
And there's also quite a lot of the other guests on the other side of that are ex-military people themselves. I mean, we're constantly doing stuff about revolving doors, so presumably quite a lot of it goes to salaries for these guys as well.
Yes, I mean, defence ministers don't tend to take the agreeable dinners, but they do after they leave working for the government, quite often take agreeable jobs in defence. So it's not always dinners. In this, the most recent quarter's list of hospitality, one person from the Air Force who's just received what the list just says, pastries from Saab, who are currently bidding to build the new advanced jet trainers.
What's the amount that it has to exceed for it to be declarable? Is it like you have one croissant, does that trip the wire, or has this guy been like someone's loading up a truck full of eclairs?
It's got to be a fair few pastries to make the list.
I respect that.
It's an entire branch of Greggs.
So another of the issues tends to be constantly changing and buying very bespoke things, but then changing your mind about exactly how bespoke.
But that's so interesting, because that then sounds a bit like what's been the problem with HS2.
Exactly.
Which is like, we could have built just really cheap railway, like in the way that other countries have done. But no, we must, not only must we respect the bat and the newt, but we must also have like the most amazing new bespoke stuff.
Yes.
Put it in a tunnel for the first 50 miles, but the tunnel has to be a one-of-a-kind tunnel we've never built before.
Made of bats. but that's interesting that's the same disease, that procurement disease, that's sort of plaguing our military procurement too.
So it's possible a lesson has been learn, because we had a story in the current Eye, which we in fact headlined with positive defence story shock, because, well, this could still go wrong, but at the moment, the army has bought 200 and odd Toyota Hilux vehicles off the shelf, and they'll make some modifications to them, but they're actually just have gone shopping and found a vehicle that works.
So
for
this
once.
Is this like the pickup truck style?
Yes.
Yeah, and so you can put a couple of tons of stuff probably in the back, the big heavy things.
I mean, they're sort of used globally by sort of unofficial militia, and one of the benefits.
But this is like
them.
That's like the AK-47, right? Yes. The notoriety, the thing that was amazing about the AK-47 was that it only had like a couple of moving parts, and therefore the choice of jihadis and people who couldn't do like expensive machine servicing everywhere, because it was just hard for it to go wrong. And like the Toyota Hilux is a very robust.
Yeah, notoriously one of the most unstoppable vehicles. And also because it's so global, there's spare parts everywhere. So if yours breaks down, you can just kind of, you know, fight some militia and get the parts off them.
So, but you're saying this is genuinely a good idea? It's not that we're retreating to the state of militia power.
Well, it's unlikely to quadruple in budget, is there?
Right.
Because there's a price for an off-the-shelf vehicle.
Yeah.
So hopefully it won't kind of 10 years time be going, oh, well, you know, they were never delivered and they only had 3 wheels. And
I mean, in preparation for this episode, I listened back to an interview that we did with Square Basher Vickers.
Mm.
I mean, this was 9 years ago.
Yes, it would be.
And all the same problems were there. I mean, back then it was the Type 45 destroyers,
yes,
which had been built even then, and I think Britain has 6 of those, HMS Dragon and so on, and they, at the time, were known, it was known that they couldn't go very well in warm water. They struggled a bit when the water was too warm, so that might make deployment to, say, the Middle East tricky.
Or Cornwall at the moment.
And lo and behold, 9 years later, we have the war in Iran breakout, and they're all being repaired and refitted and things, and it takes 9 days to get one of them out of Portsmouth. So
yes,
the problems, they go way back.
Yes, and the mine-hunting mothership that we can send is not specially built after a massive procurement exercise. It's a second-hand ship that we bought from an offshore oil and gas exploration company.
Wow.
HMS Stirling Castle.
And I believe there's been an announcement of a bit more money for drones. And seeing what's happening in Ukraine, the unbelievable speed at which the Ukrainian military get their drones into service, into testing, into the field. They try them quickly. Yeah. If it doesn't work, they change it. Is there anything that we can learn here? It feels like we must be able.
Partly because sort of we're doing work with the Ukrainians for this. There's, for instance, the new brake stop drones, which are partly designed by the company that designs Formula E cars. So it's not a conventional defence company. It's a tech engineering company. But yes, yeah, so they're kind of, again, relatively cheap and cheerful that, you know, want to turn out hundreds of them for Ukraine, but the tech will be available for the UK military.
If you were put in charge of procurement, or if you were made Defence Secretary, and we'll probably all get a go.
I'd be buying a lot of maps and scissors.
But do you think procurement just needs to change completely? I mean, it sounds like it's just so bedeviled, and it has been for so long.
Yeah, I think they need to seriously consider who we buy from and why. There's a lot of decisions that are about, well, if we can give this company a £200 million contract, then they'll build a factory in Wales. But not quite pinning that down. So the factory in Wales doesn't necessarily even happen. But we spend a lot of money on kind of courting these very big defence and engineering companies.
Is that because so much defence has to be in country for obvious reasons that you don't want to just, you can't outsource it to the other side of the world? It's a national security thing. So you have to have it here.
Well, you would think. But then when you look at just how much we spend with the US and how badly some of that's worked around things like the fighter jets and so on.
Right.
I mean, obviously, we have to really spend with our allies, but it's not so much the case that we do all our defence spending within the UK.
I guess just supply chains are much more global, and it's very hard to have a completely in-country supply chain, of course.
Yeah. There's a sort of early idea goes into it that, well, if us and the Italians and the Japanese, for instance, all club together to buy a thing,
yeah,
then it'll be cheaper. But then it works out that you've kind of constantly got to deal with the competing wishes of three different governments, all of who want to change the spec slightly.
Well, that's interesting, because one of these new drone programs has been announced this week, and it's giving three suppliers a grand total of £3 million. Better, that's smaller, to develop low-cost interceptors to shoot down drones. But I think that is a five-country thing, but it feels like quite a small thing.
Yes, yeah.
Which, again, feels like a step in the right direction.
We seem to be better at doing innovation on a small scale, but as soon as the resources get very big...
Yeah.
Then... This is your map fetish again, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Just all you need is a pair of ladies' bloomers with
it sounds like we need
compass sewn in them.
It sounds like Scrap Heap Challenge is basically the model going forward for the British Armed Forces.
I mean, if you look at what's happening in Ukraine, Scrap Heap Challenge is, I mean, things that you can repair are very important.
Right.
So, yes.
Regular listeners may know that Adam specializes in hariology, hariography, and the Daily
Mail. I never
Mail.
Meant to. I just got dragged in.
It's that and the sale of the Telegraph, which finally has concluded.
Yeah.
Huge week for you.
All over. Yeah.
So the et al. Trial against the Daily Mail group has come to a conclusion. For any readers who might have not been paying attention, how'd it go?
Not good for Harry and the others. It's officially Lawrence and others versus Associated Newspapers. Lawrence in question being, of course, Baroness Lawrence, mother of murdered Stephen Lawrence, who was kind of pulled into this case by Harry. Specifically, he sent her a text at the suggestion of the lawyer David Sherborne, who he had met on holiday at Elton John and David Furnish's house. They're also in this case as well. So it's got all human life is here. I have ploughed through all 436 pages of Mr. Justice Nicklin's judgment, which came out last week, sort of desperately combing for a single crumb in there that might have given some comfort to Prince Harry and his fellow litigants. There really isn't one. It is the most comprehensive dismissal of all of their claims.
Wow.
I've ever seen, I think, in a legal judgment.
So they were claiming in their lawsuit that all of these stories in the Mail over a very long period of time had been based on illegally acquired information. Whether that was phone hacking or other methods, it was improperly acquired.
Unlawful information gathering is the phrase that they use. So it covered a bit of phone hacking, voicemails. At the start of the trial, when it was first announced, or the start of the case when it was first announced back in 2022, there were allegations of burglaries to order, of recording of landline phone calls, of microphones being stuck to people's windows to eavesdrop on. All of that dropped away in the course of this trial. It's extraordinary. What they were left with, essentially, was testimony, witness statements from a load of supposedly repentant phone hackers and private eyes who had done very dodgy things on behalf of other newspaper groups. Or possibly, it then turned out, when they changed their stories partway through the litigation, hadn't been at all. So a lot of it depended on the testimony of a guy called Gavin Burrows. A witness statement appeared at an early stage in the litigation in which he said he'd been doing all sorts of work for the Daily Mail and the Mail on Sunday, all sorts of the dodgy stuff that we've heard about from the News of the World and from Mirror Group before. He then turned tail on that, said absolutely he'd never worked for the Daily Mail and Mail on Sunday ever in his life. And that witness statement was actually a forgery, which had been made by a couple of the paralegal, or one of the paralegals who was working on the case, a guy called Graham Johnson, who is one of these repentant phone hackers.
So what, he turned from a prosecution witness to a defence witness?
Well, in the end, neither of them wanted him at all, because he turned out to be such a liability in court. There was a lot of debate, which I wrote about in private at the time, over whether he was going to be allowed into court at all. There was an application partway through to turn him into a hostile witness, and he would be treated as that. And what Mr. Justice Nicklin concluded in the end was that his credibility was comprehensively undermined. His evidence was argumentative, evasive, internally inconsistent, and at times extraordinary. And it was. I mean, there were claims of he'd sort of darkly hinted at working for MI6 and the Secret Services and all sorts of things.
Can I just say, Gavin Burrows is an unbelievably good name for an investigative hack. I don't think we've ever made that point before, have we?
It's like a full sentence.
He's a sentence person.
Yeah.
He was a private investigator rather than a journalist. And this was
name.
Okay. This was part of the problem. But I mean, this is just what ended up, what really comes through in the judgment is that essentially, these people started off with a sense that their privacy had been horribly invaded, which in some cases it actually had been. I mean, there were a lot of stories. I felt very sympathetic reading through it to Sadie Frost, who you remember was part of that Primrose Hill set. She was married to Jude Law, and there were all sorts of shenanigans and a breakup of a marriage and kind of messiness around that. She was friends with Kate Moss and all these kind of people. And there was some really intrusive reporting, I think everyone would have to say, of her life at the time. Interestingly, even at the time, the most intrusive story was about her suffering an ectopic pregnancy and being fronted up about that by a journalist called Katie Nicholl.
Fronted up?
Fronted up, as in contacted and asked to comment on it.
Yeah.
This story was felt to be too intrusive, never actually appeared at all, and none of us would be any the wiser about it had this litigation not occurred kind of 20 years later. But then in other cases, I mean, the allegations on which claims of unlawful information gathering were based seemed so slight as to be almost non-existent. So one of Baroness Lawrence's cases, it turned on two words, literally. So this was a report of, there was going to be a full public inquiry into the murder of Stephen Lawrence, a story which turned out to have been given to Paul Dacre, then editor of the Daily Mail, on very, very good sourcing. It was the Home Secretary, Jack Straw, told him privately. They were old mates from university. He told him that. But there was a line in it which said, "The family will decide soon whether to bring a second private prosecution for murder." And the claim in court was that the words "decide soon" meant that they must have had a voicemail interception or something in order that they knew this was going to happen. Now, the judge said it couldn't be the result of blagging, or was very unlikely to be the result of blagging. He said there was a perfectly reasonable assumed timescale from inference and prior reporting. Essentially, there'd been other reporting saying they were considering this. And "decide soon" is one of those, I mean, it's those phrases we use like "recently," which can cover a multitude of sins, isn't it? I mean, it's just a likely
fudging
thing to happen.
It's saying we don't have a timescale for this, but they'll have to decide soon or they'll run out of time.
Can I ask about the cost? Because I think one of the things that came out was that, you know, in the kind of custody, essentially the Mail and Harry have got one of the Lawrences each. So Stephen Lawrence's dad wrote a piece for the Mail saying they stuck by us, have been staunch. Obviously, the way that the Mail sees it is that kind of Doreen Lawrence was kind of recruited by Harry to be essentially a much more sympathetic claimant than him. And this wasn't celebrity tittle-tattle. This was the mother of a murdered son. Is she on the hook for costs? Because there was this suggestion that the judge's ruling was so critical of Harry et al. That their libel insurance or their court insurance wasn't going to cover them, and they were actually on the hook for essentially punitive costs, which the Mail said about like 50 million.
It's not quite punitive. I mean, the next stage of this, because it ain't over yet, is a cost hearing, which is going over 2 days at the end of the month. That is going to involve not punitive damages, but I love this. Mr. Justice Nixon describes it not as the cost hearing, but the consequentials hearing. Which is really like, there will be consequences. Yes.
It does sound a bit from what you were saying that Justice Nixon does not, was not impressed with Harry's legal team, Harry's advisors hacked off.
He was absolutely not impressed with them. I spent a couple of days in court covering this, and he was the attitude was David Sherborne, who was the barrister who was leading the celebrities, we'll call them that, case. It was very, very spiky. He was openly critical of it, and he essentially
and this wasn't tried by a jury.
No, this was the judge sitting on his own. He's incredibly critical of the way that they prosecuted. He said, essentially, it started off that the accusation was that all of these private detectives working kind of at arm's length for the Mail Group had been doing the unlawful stuff. They had various ledgers which had been acquired by Graham Johnson, one of the paralegals involved in the case, who also runs his own investigative website and wrote a lot of this stuff, a lot of which was paid for with money that came from people like Max Mosley, which was an issue in the case. Obviously, that came up, and the judge ruled that actually there was no distinction between effectively gathering evidence for the trial and gathering journalistic material for his website. So, when we talked about this before, you were saying you're not allowed to pay witnesses, and the argument by the claimants was they weren't paying for the witness statements; they were just paying for these accounts in various books and articles for this internet site that just happened to coincide exactly with what they then said in their witness statements. Before, in some cases, they said no, we never ever said that at all, and it's a forgery.
But then the thing is that he was so unimpressed with them that he could then essentially say, you should never have brought this. Not like you're vexatious litigants entirely, but like, you've taken the piss, essentially, and I'm going to make you pay a lot of money to the Daily Mail beyond what your insurance will cover.
You've taken the piss, essentially, is in slightly more legalese, or what he said. He said that eventually when all of that fell away, there was a case when journalists were actually on the witness stand talking about how they'd acquired these stories, where Sherborne put direct accusations to them that they had been involved in phone tapping or voicemail hacking. And he said that this was serious allegations not supported by a properly pleaded case or evidence capable of sustaining them. Now, that is, I think, judge speak for you're taking the piss,
yeah,
essentially. And this will come back to bite them in terms of the costs now, because I mean the Mail are briefing that they've spent about that the total cost for this case are around £50 million. I mean, this is sort of money that will make Nigel Farage's eye light up, isn't it? They are also now applying for not punitive damages, but an indemnity order, which essentially says there isn't a cap on the costs they can charge to the other side because it's such a comprehensive loss. This is just the straightforward rule in the British legal system that the losing side pays the costs of the other side as well as their own. What that means, an indemnity order will allow allow them to secure compensation to as full an extent as possible for the outlay and trouble of litigation. And that was enormous. I mean, it's essentially, there were several members of staff at the senior members of staff at the Mail who carried on kind of in their jobs just to deal with this litigation, including their head of legal, Liz Hartley, and Paul Dacre as well, who is sort of up in a belfry somewhere at the top of the Daily Mail. Being very, very happy at the moment.
Recorded a video in which he took the opportunity to personally slag off Max Mosley now that he's dead, which you could really tell that this again, like this, much like Farage and his daughter, this one was very personal for Paul Dacre, who, as I've said before, had the murderer's front page on the wall of his office for years. That to him was a sign that, you know, people said all these things about the Daily Mail being racist, but here they'd gone to bat for a young murdered black guy killed by white thugs. And he was so proud of that. I think that's part of the reason that they fought it so hard.
And it was genuinely that, and the reporting by Stephen Wright, the crime editor on the Lawrence case, all the way through. You know, it sort of lasted years before there were eventually a couple of successful prosecutions. He was then directly accused, and he spoke actually quite movingly on the stand about how awful it was to be accused of this. The allegation was put to him that it came from racism. He pointed out that he has a black wife and mixed race kids, and he found this a sort of completely abhorrent. And that is certainly the feeling. This was genuine emotion, if you can imagine such a thing, within Daily Mail towers.
I can imagine Justice Nicklin at that point is more like, could this is just sort of like, are you still beating your wife level kind of questions being put to people. This feels like a very, should we say, ill-advised litigation strategy.
You mean accusing the hacks themselves of the unlawful activity?
You can't really go into court and say, but you did some phone hacking, didn't you? That's how you got this story. Without being able to then say, and here's the notebook that has your number in it, here's the whatever, which is what happened in some of those News of the World cases, right? That they'd got some hard evidence behind it. Their theory seems to have been, it's the kind of thing that people like you would have done. So you must have done it.
And in some cases, there were actually, the names came up of freelance journalists doing bits for the Mail and being the sources of some of these stories, who have been mentioned in previous successful phone hacking litigation, and the suggestion being that they must have been doing it for the Mail as well. The judge was extremely clear that you actually, for every single accusation that was made, the claimants had to argue a specific payment and have actual evidence of it, and nothing could be done by inference or what he called propensity, that, you know, which is essentially that argument of, well, we're all up to this sort of thing.
Does this change anything about the way journalism is going to be done? Or maybe the way that lawsuits are going to be waged about this? Because this has been such a long process, you know, from when the phone hacking was happening. I mean, now this is the long tail of legal action stretching
out. It really, really is, yeah. I mean, the answer to that is no, but because it's changed already, essentially. Yeah. I mean, none of this stuff, as I was saying, those stories about Sadie Frost and that very, very intrusive stuff, it doesn't really happen anymore. I mean, celebrities work in a different way. They're putting their own stories and curating their own lives out on Instagram, and it's much, much easier and cheaper for newspapers just to report things that way. There isn't that sort of... None of these stories were recent ones. This is going back to that sort of classic period of slightly Wild West pre-Leveson.
Right, you've got a class now of celebrities who are influencers who essentially, following more like the Katie Price model, know that everything that they do is for sale, and that the only reason they'd be annoyed with the tabs is if they jumped the gun and meant that they couldn't announce things themselves.
Yeah.
So do you think this is the last...
I would be very, very surprised if any lawyer is prepared to work on a conditional fee agreement on any further cases like this. And essentially, there's no one else to go after now. I mean, we had the Mirror litigation, we had the litigation against the News of the World, we've had further litigation against the Sun, where we've had these bizarre settlements where Rupert Murdoch has just handed over enormous amounts of money for people who claim that they had their phones hacked by the Sun, but said there's no admission of any guilt in this. I just like giving money away.
Right.
It's another person who should contact Nigel Farage. This was essentially the last of those big newspaper groups who were likely to be accused of these sorts of things, and they have been comprehensively cleared by this.
Can I ask whether or not there is anything in the judgment about, some people will remember the private eye players and our dramatic reading of the Facebook messages between Harry and Charlotte Griffiths of the Mail on Sunday?
Charlotte Griffiths of the Mail on Sunday.
H-bomb.
Looks like she's in the room again. She's come back.
Which is, I have to say, which was the moment I thought, I don't think this is going very well for Harry, actually. But did that did that come up at all?
Amazingly, it doesn't, because those Facebook messages between Charlotte Griffiths and Prince Harry were not actually cited in court. They were put in as evidence, but never actually... We provided the dramatic reading of them, which was so absent from that lengthy
I might put case. In for a cost here.
But we have had, I would say, in the Daily Mail, on the I think it was the day after the judgment came through, we have had Charlotte Griffiths' own account of her nights of cuddles and film nights, which actually kicked off with a detail that wasn't in those Facebook messages, which is when she first met Prince Harry... He gave her a small white pill and put it on her tongue and said, "Now I know I can trust you."
Which
she claimed, probably paracetamol. She took it straight out again and hid it in a napkin.
That is in the greatest tradition of, and then I made my excuses and left, isn't it? And I'm absolutely sure it was paracetamol. Yeah,
so I think that gives you a sign of the sort of treatment which Prince Harry, and I have to say a lot of the other litigants in this case, can expect from the Daily Mail titles in future.
Well, you'll be hearing about it on page 94. Thank you very much, Adam. thanks too to Helen and Jane. Thank you to you for listening. If you would like to get a copy of Private Eye, with many stories about Toyota Hiluxes, about Type 45 destroyers, about Prince Harry, about Rupert Lowe, about many, many more things, all the things our colleagues brilliantly write about. It is available in shops. It's also available at private-eye.co.uk, where subscriptions are even more reasonably priced than a single issue of the magazine. That's it for now. The only person remaining to thank is Matt Hill of Rethink Audio for producing. Thank you to Matt, and bye for now.
They're so cheap, you could also afford to pay to have Nigel Farage read it out to you on Cameo.